Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply. CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure, with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Welcome to the Science of Success. Introducing your host, Matt Bodner.
Welcome to the Science of Success, the number one evidence-based growth podcast on the internet. With more than 1 million downloads, listeners in over 100 countries, and part of the Self-Help for Smart People podcast network. In this episode, we go deep into a scientific look at consciousness. We ask, how do our brains experience reality? What is consciousness? Is our perception of reality nothing more than a controlled hallucination? What is the hard problem of consciousness, and what are the major aspects of consciousness? How can we use the neuroscience of consciousness to better ourselves and improve our lives? We dig into that and much more with our guest, Anil Seth. I'm going to give you three reasons why you should join our email list today by going to successpodcast.com and signing up right on the homepage. There's some amazing stuff that's only available to our email subscribers, so be sure to sign up and join the email list today. First, you're going to get an awesome free guide that we created based on listener demand. This is our most popular guide, and it's called How to Organize and Remember Everything, which you can get completely for free, along with another surprise bonus guide. You got to sign up to find out by joining the email list today. Next, you're going to get a curated weekly email from us every week called Mindset Monday. Our listeners have been absolutely loving this email. It's short, it's simple, it's filled with articles, videos, stories, things we've found interesting or fascinating in the last week. Lastly, you're going to get exclusive content and a chance to shape the show. You can help us vote on guests. You can help us change our intro music and much more. You can even submit your own questions to upcoming guests. You'll also have access to exclusive giveaways that only people who are on the email list get access to, and much, much more. Be sure to sign up and join the email list. There's some incredible stuff, but only subscribers who are on the email list are getting access to this awesome information. In our previous episode, we looked at how to use insights from behavioral science to improve your life. We looked at what it means to have a good day and figured out how to reverse engineer more good days in your life by examining decision-making, the power of rest and recovery, intention setting, boundaries, and much more with our guest, Caroline Webb. If you want to learn how to use scientific research to create more good days in your life, Listen to that episode. Now for the show.
Today, we have another exciting guest on the show, Anil Seth. Anil is the professor of cognitive and computational neuroscience at the University of Sussex. He's the co-director of the Sackler Center for Consciousness Science, the editor-in-chief of the Neuroscience of Consciousness, and was president of the British Science Association for Psychology in 2017. His TED Talk has been viewed over 2.5 million times, and his work has been featured in The Guardian, BBC, New Scientist, and more. Anil, welcome to the Science of Success.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me on.
Well, we're very excited to have you on here today. I know you do some really fascinating some work and research, and I'm excited to kind of dig into many of these topics today. So to start out, I'd love to begin with kind of the idea of consciousness and kind of the question of how does our brain experience reality?
Well, that's the big question, I think, that certainly I'm trying to answer and certainly that's motivated me in my career. And studying consciousness is a funny thing, right? It's consciousness, let's be clear, we don't have a very, very good scientific definition of it. Everybody knows what consciousness is. It's what goes away when you fall into a dreamless sleep or go under general anesthesia, and it's what returns when you come around again. It's any kind of subjective experience. There is something it is like to be me, and I'm sure there's something it is like to be you. And for everybody listening, there is also something it is like to be them. There's a subjective experience that's happening for those organisms. And there isn't the thing, you know, we assume that's not the case for something like a table or a chair. It may be the case for something like a worm or a fish, but we don't really know yet. But the question is, for some things in the universe, there are conscious experiences, and for other things, there probably aren't. And this is one of the biggest mysteries in science and philosophy. People have been thinking about it forever. And one of the things that's always surprised me is, for a lot of the 20th century at least, explicitly studying consciousness was not really considered to be a legitimate part of psychology and neuroscience, which is, I think it's kind of hilarious because it's the most obvious phenomenon. It's where everything else starts from. Nothing else really matters. If there's one central feature of psychology, of neuroscience, it's the fact that we have conscious experiences. So how that happens is really, I think, the most interesting and the most basic question in much of science. And it's also tractable. I mean, if there's one thing that we know about consciousness, at least in humans, it's that it's intimately dependent on the brain. And the brain stops, consciousness stops. Change the brain in various ways, your conscious experience of the world and the self will also change. So there are perfectly valid and productive scientific methods that we can apply to the study of consciousness and begin to figure out what it is about the brain, and not just the brain in a kind of jam jar on a lab bench, but the brain in the body, in the world. What is it about this whole interconnected system that gives rise to having conscious experiences in the first place and then shapes the kinds of experiences that we have, whether they're experiences of perceptions of the world around us or of the experience of being an individual, being a person, being a conscious self. With all the emotion and sense of embodiment, all these other things that go along with that. So that there is a very, very urgent, it's both important, interesting, and urgent scientific question to ask. And I'd say it's urgent because it's probably only through a scientific understanding of consciousness that we will come to have a proper mechanistic understanding of what happens in cases of psychiatric illness, for instance, and I'm sure we'll probably come onto this later on. But if you want to develop a proper understanding of distressing sets of conscious experiences that characterize psychiatric problems, well, we need to understand what the mechanisms are. So that's just stating the problem, and then I guess we can go in various ways to try to find answers.
So is that kind of, you know, when you do some sort of cursory research or reading around consciousness, you'll come across the phrase, the hard problem of consciousness. Is that what you're describing, or is that something distinct?
That's right. The hard problem is a phrase that's due to the philosopher David Chalmers, who's been a terrific influence in consciousness science and philosophy for more than a quarter century now. And there really isn't one single problem of consciousness. I think that's another important thing to establish at the get-go. It's a bit like biology, there's no single problem of life either. There's a lot of problems that cluster under the same basic description. So what are the problems of consciousness? Well, the hard problem, the chanas, is a contrast between two kinds of things. It's a contrast between the hard problem and the easy problem. So I'll put it like this. The easy problem, the chanas, is the problem of figuring out how brains do what they do, how they implement various functions, how they guide behavior, how they allow the world to be sensed so that behavior can happen appropriately, how the thing works as a mechanism. This is, of course, not an easy problem. It's going to keep neuroscientists and biologists busy for centuries. But the point about the easy problem is it doesn't necessarily make any reference to consciousness at all. It's just about, you know, how the complex networks of neurons together support the kinds of things that organisms do. The hard problem is explaining how and why any of this should have anything to do with conscious experience. How could any explanation that is made in terms of mechanisms or functions, you know, this neuron's connected to this neuron, connected to that neuron, so how could any explanation of that kind tell you why a conscious experience happens? And the intuition in making this distinction is that it just doesn't. That however sophisticated, detailed your understanding of the brain as a mechanism is, it will leave entirely untouched this basic mystery of how and why conscious experiences happen to be part of the universe in the first place. That's why Chalmers calls it a hard problem, because it's almost as if it's beyond the remit of any kind of science or neuroscience. Now, I have struggled with this. I think it's a very interesting point of view, and it goes right back in philosophy, of course, to Descartes and before, where you cleave the universe into two different kinds of things, stuff is made out of, and the stuff of thought and of conscious experience. So once you've cut the universe in two this way, it's very difficult to put it together again. Now, figuring out a solution to the hard problem is, well, we just don't know what that would look like, although people have come up with some kinds of speculative ideas. But I guess my point is, we don't need to solve the hard problem in order to pursue a very productive and illuminating science of consciousness. So we know that consciousness exists. We have conscious experiences, and they can be described in various ways. I can describe how my experience of vision is different from my experience of an emotion, which is different from my experience of volition, of intending to do something. And given that these conscious experiences exist, and they also go away under general anesthesia or sleep, things like that, then we can start to just explore how mechanisms within the brain explain aspects of these conscious experiences, explain the difference between, let's say, vision and hearing and smell and self. And that way, we're saying testable and predictable things about the relationships between the brain and consciousness. And we can just, you know, it may seem a bit unsatisfying, but we can just leave aside the question of how and why consciousness comes to be part of the universe in the first place. And, you know, this isn't really a cop-out. I don't think it's a cop-out at all, because the history of science has pursued this strategy very successfully many times before. I mean, even in physics, physicists cannot tell you why there is a universe in the first place. Nonetheless, we understand a great deal about it now, thanks to the methods of theoretical and experimental physics. Another analogy that's not exactly a true analogy, but it's interesting, is life. So it wasn't that long ago, biologists thought that there could be no mechanistic explanation of the difference between the living and the non-living. So they would propose something, you know, like an élan vital or a spark of life to some sort of special source that would explain that difference. And of course, now, while we don't understand everything about life, this basic sense of mystery about what life is has faded away as biologists just got on with the job of accounting for the properties of living systems. So I think we can do the same with consciousness. We can just start to explain its properties. We can do the normal business of science, which is develop theories that help explain, help control, help predict, and see how we go. And this is, in fact, what's going on in my lab and in many other labs in the world. And I think a lot of really interesting progress is being made. It's interesting to think why people find this unsatisfying. I think there's a sense in which people ask more of a science of consciousness than they ask of other kinds of science. And I think this is partly because it's so central to our own existence. We're being faced with the challenge of coming up for a scientific explanation of what it is to be me or to be you. And so there's something, I think, intuitive that we want. There's firstly, there's a resistance to something like that being explained. You know, we want to cling on to ourselves as somehow special. And then we also maybe ask more of a kind of scientific explanation of consciousness, that it should be really intuitively satisfying somehow. And we don't apply these criteria in other areas of science at all. So I don't think we should do so in consciousness. We can just look at the brain, look at conscious experiences, and get on with the job.
So let's dig in a little bit around the properties of consciousness. Tell me more about that.
There's a long list of ways to divide up what we mean by consciousness. I like to think of it quite simply in terms of three different aspects of consciousness. And I don't think these three aspects are entirely independent. I think there are complicated relations between them. But I think it's a useful starting point. So the first property of consciousness is conscious level. And this I would describe as sort of scale from being completely lacking in any kind of consciousness at all, such as when you're under general anesthesia or in a coma or dead, let's say, all the way to being vividly alert, awake, aware, and conscious, fully conscious. Now, the important thing here is that conscious level is not the same thing as just being physiologically awake. You can have conscious experiences when you're asleep. This is what happens when you dream. And there's also cases on the other side, if you like, where if you've had severe brain damage, been very unlucky to have some severe brain damage, you might end up in what was once called the vegetative state, now called the unaware wakeful state, which is a state where you will go through sleep and wake cycles, and your eyes will open, physiologically you will wake up, but there doesn't seem to be any conscious experience going on at all. So the mechanisms that are responsible for being conscious, you know, they can overlap with, but they're not going to be the same as the mechanisms that just modulate whether you're physiologically awake or asleep. So that's conscious level. The second aspect is what I would like to call conscious content, which is when you're conscious of something. This is probably what most people intuitively think of. You know, you look around, there's a subjective scene. It has, you open your eyes and you're not blind, you open your eyes, there's colors, shapes, objects of various kinds populating this visual scene, clouds on the horizon, and whatever you happen to be looking at. But there's also the whatever you might be smelling at the time, hearing at the time. Then there are the senses of, you know, tactile senses of your body sitting on a chair and so on. It's the full content of your perceptual scene at any one time. That's conscious content. And again, we know there's not only differences between different perceptual modalities like vision and hearing and smell, but the brain can do a lot of this sensing of the world without consciousness being involved at all. So we're not necessarily conscious of everything that our eyes and ears detect. And the third and final aspect of consciousness is actually a subset of conscious content, but it's a particularly important subset. And that's the experience of being a particular person, of being me, of being you, the experience of being the subject of that experience. And you know, it's this experience of being somebody that is probably the aspect of consciousness that we feel most attached to and we're most resistant to it being explained. And it's also that aspect of consciousness that can go wrong, if you like, in a lot of psychiatric conditions.
I want to segue and get into a little bit the way that we perceive reality and the way that we perceive the world. And you've talked about in the past the idea of perceptual predictions and then how we're not necessarily sort of passively perceiving what's happening around us, but in many instances, kind of actively creating it. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, this is an old idea, but I think it's gaining a new relevance now. And I think this is a relevance that actually makes a difference to me in my everyday life. Now, there's a kind of intuitive way to think about sensation and perception as part of our conscious lives, which is that you know, there's a world out there, and our eyes and our ears and our other sensory organs detect features of this world. You know, light waves, energy hits our retina and so on, gets converted into signals, go deeper and deeper into the brain. And that sensation and perception is this process of interpretation, of just the building up of sensory signals that originate from some sort of fixed external world that's out there. Now, there's another view, and again, this goes back in philosophy to Kant, if not before, and in psychology to a guy called Hermann von Helmholtz in the late 19th century. And he argued that perception was not so much just about this passive registration of sensory data that just impacts our sensory organs. It's an act of construction, that the sensory signals that we encounter, I mean, they don't come labeled with this is vision, you know, this comes from a table, this is sound, this comes from my friend. It's all just energy, and it's all kind of noisy and ambiguous and only indirectly related to what's out there in the world. But our perception, or at least our conscious perception, seems to be populated by determinate objects. You know, I'm now looking at the computer in front of me and the mug of tea in front of me, and they seem to be there. So how does this happen? Well, the idea is that the brain meets this noisy and ambiguous stream of sensory information with what we call prior predictions or expectations about what caused that sensory information. So what we see is not the sensory data itself or any kind of, you know, filtering of it. What we see is the brain's interpretation or the brain's best guess about what caused that sensory data. And depending on what that best guess is, your perception will be different. Think of if you go out on outside on a day where it's kind of cloudy, there are these, you know, nice little white fluffy clouds. It can be very easy to look at those clouds and see faces in them or see animals in them, see something strange in them. You know, what's happening there is that the brain is imposing an expectation of seeing a face onto some quite ambiguous sensory data. And so that's what you actually see. And I think we, you know, we've all had the experience as well, walking out maybe on a foggy day and you think you see your friend because you're expecting to meet them and it turns out to be a stranger. So our perceptions are always shaped by the interpretations our brain brings to bear. And we're not conscious of these predictions so much. We're just conscious of the results. We're conscious of how these predictions become combined with the sensory data. That shapes our perception. So I think this is quite transformational for the way we think of the way we perceive the world around us. I mean, we have this sort of naive realism that we think, or it just seems to us that the world is out there as we perceive it. You know, have that phrase, you know, I believe it when I see it. You might as well say the other way around, that, you know, you only see things that you believe. And these beliefs can be unconscious. What this means is we probably all perceive the world in slightly different ways, sometimes maybe in very different ways, depending on the expectations that our brain brings to bear on the sensory data. So we all inhabit kind of different inner universes this way.
And in your TED Talk, you have some really great examples of this. It may be hard to kind of demonstrate in the podcast format, but, you know, I really found sort of the example of kind of the checkerboard shadow to be really, really fascinating. And also the kind of the auditory illusion that you created during the show, which we'll throw those in the show notes for listeners. But I thought those were great examples.
Yeah, there's a lot of examples that we come to every day. I mean, optical illusions are a great source of, if you like, kind of improvised or discovered experiments in psychology and neuroscience. You know, optical illusions work because we're just made to realize this discrepancy between the way things are and how we perceive them. You know, these two lines, you might have two lines, one looks longer than the other, and then you measure them, they're both the same length, but they still look different lengths. The checkerboard example that you mentioned, I think this is a beautiful example. That's based on is, you know, our brain, or the visual system in our brain, just knows that objects get darker when they're in shadow. That's the kind of rule that the visual cortex in our brain has either was born with, or it's genetically wired in now, or we learn it in the first few years of life. That means that the brain is expecting the patterns of shadow to change sensory data in particular ways. And this illusion is called Adelson's checkerboard. Just means that we see two patches of gray they're going to look to be very, very different. But if you go and actually, you know, cut the patches out and put them next to each other, you'll see they're exactly the same color. So what's happening here is, you know, our perception isn't just a direct reflection of what color a patch is. It's really what color the patch should be given the pattern of light and shade that's happening. And I always use that example as well, just to, you know, some people think, oh, that means my, you know, my vision isn't working very well. You know, why is biology screwed up and given me this visual system that can't actually figure out what color something is? Well, that's not what the visual system's supposed to do. It's not supposed to figure out how much light is hitting the eye. It's supposed to figure out what's the most likely state of affairs out there in the environment. And it does it beautifully. So all these optical illusions and little visual tricks that we have, thought of the right way, what they really demonstrate is how beautifully sophisticated and well adapted our visual system is to dealing with the noisy visual information that we get by using these regularities about light and shade and concavity and convexity and any number of other things to actually generate for the organism a reliable picture of what's going on in the world around it.
I think this larger point, kind of zooming back out a little bit, is really, really important, which is this idea that, you know, we think of the world outside of ourselves as this sort of fixed entity that's precisely defined, and we're sort of passively perceiving it. But in many ways, our own perceptions of what's happening around us are, in many cases, as you called them, sort of a controlled hallucination.
Yeah, I think that's it's a nice phrase. I wish I could take credit for it. That's, I first heard that phrase from Chris Frith, who's a psychologist, one of my inspirations in London, and actually nobody knows who first said it. But I mean, the idea of the controlled hallucination is that when we think of the word hallucination, we typically think of people perceiving things that aren't there. I think we can almost think of it as just a slight imbalance in how normal perception works. So even normal perception, as we've been discussing, normal perception involves this continual balancing act between sensory data and the brain's interpretations of that sensory data. Now, when you look at the white fluffy clouds and see a face in them, that's a kind of hallucination going on there. And so you can think of the sorts of hallucinations that people describe in schizophrenia or perhaps on, you know, on psychoactive drugs of various kinds. That's just tipping the balance even more so that the brain's prior expectations kind of overweight the sensory data and overwhelm the sensory data even more strongly, so that what we perceive becomes less dependent on signals from the world. So normal perception is a controlled hallucination, precisely this sense that the brain is always anticipating, always predicting what's out there. But these predictions are controlled because they're always constrained and reined in and guided by the sensory data that we encounter. And it's when that process goes wrong, becomes imbalanced either one way or the other way, that we start to see deviations from normal perception that people, you know, then start to worry about, because it's, you know, then they start disagreeing with people around them about what's actually going on. But there's another thing. I mean, we're beginning to be familiar with this idea in another context already. So a lot of people talk about echo chambers and filter bubbles in social media. We seek evidence that fits with our beliefs. And if we only expose to particular kinds of opinions because of the way social media works, the echo chamber phenomenon, then, well, that's the way we will believe the world to be one way. And other people inhabiting the same world will hold a very different set of beliefs because their echo chamber is different, because the sensory information they encounter and the prior beliefs they bring to bear are also different. I think the work that we're doing, and me and many colleagues, is showing the same thing applies to more basic levels too. It's not just, you know, your abstract belief about what kind of politics is good. It also drills right down to how we perceive colors and shapes and things and objects in the world around us. Now, maybe not to such a degree, because probably a lot of the visual system is quite hardwired and quite, you know, inflexible, but it's there to some degree, or at least the potential for it is there to some degree. And I think it is a very important thing to realize, just this this fact that we will have different or potentially different experiences of the world around us at this concrete perceptual level and not just at a more abstract level of beliefs and desires.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Hiring the right person takes time. Time that you often don't have. But you shouldn't let a time crunch get in the way of finding the right candidates for your business. That's why LinkedIn is the best place to post your job. In fact, I was on LinkedIn Jobs this morning looking for candidates to fill a key role in one of my businesses. LinkedIn Jobs screens candidates with hard and soft skills you're looking for so that you can hire the right person quickly. You can look for things like collaboration, creativity, and adaptability, looking beyond just work skills and resumes to connect you with the candidates who are a perfect match for your business. That's how LinkedIn makes sure that your job post gets in front of the people you actually want to hire, because they have a much better ability to get a deep insight into exactly who is the right candidate for you and your business. Find the right person meant for your business today with LinkedIn Jobs. You can pay what you want, and the first $50 is on them. Just visit linkedin.com/success. Again, that's linkedin.com/success to get $50 off your first job post. Terms and conditions apply.
And I think the fact that it's sort of such a concrete physical manifestation of this phenomenon really underscores the fundamental conclusion that what we perceive and believe to be true may not be the case, whether it's physical, whether it's kind of an ideological construct. And I think this, the example of the social media echo chamber is a perfect example of this. You know, we shouldn't always be so confident that our perceptions are correct. And I think if you look at some of the greatest thinkers and scientists, you know, they come from a very humble perspective of constantly kind of questioning their own perceptions and ideas. And I think it's really interesting to see that mirrored, you know, not only from kind of an intellectual sense of, you know, you look at something like a social media echo chamber, but really at a very basic physical sense, all the way down to the way that our consciousness is created.
That's right. I mean, I think there's the value of skepticism, of an informed skepticism, you know, is just, it's always there in whatever context you want to discuss. And you know, another metaphor people have often used for the way we've been discussing perception is a process of hypothesis testing. So, you know, the brain might have a hypothesis, a best guess about the way the world is, and then it'll test that hypothesis with sensory data. It will try to seek out sensory data that will either confirm or disconfirm its hypothesis, in much the same way that a scientist would have a hypothesis and do an experiment that might confirm or disconfirm their scientific hypothesis. And yeah, you know, of course, if you take that all the way, then I'm also have to remain very skeptical about everything that I've been saying about consciousness. I could be entirely wrong about it too. It's just another hypothesis. But of course, that's the beauty of the scientific approach to these things, is that we will continue to do the experiments. And if all these ideas about perception being prediction turn out to be off the mark, we'll find out and we'll come up with a better theory. So yeah, there's skepticism is great all the way, but it's even better when you can test it against the court of reality.
I want to segue now and talk a little bit about, we've talked about the external world, but you know, this same phenomenon applies to our perceptions of the self and of ourselves. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
This is where things get really interesting for me. And it's where it gets intuitively challenging from my own first person perspective on these issues as well. Because it's, yeah, I think it's one thing to think about how our perception of the external world is a construction. You know, I'm okay if somebody tells me, look, there's no such thing as the color red out there. That's something that the brain has sort of invented as a convenient representation of a certain kind of invariance in the way light reflects from surfaces. That's fine. You know, I can, you know, redness is something that my brain is generating to make the world more understandable. And optical illusions, fine. Yeah, okay, those two lines, they are actually the same length, even though they look different. I'll accept that and move on with my life. Now, it becomes more challenging when you take exactly the same principles, exactly the same mechanisms, and exactly the same lessons and apply them to our perception of self. Because the experience of being a self, of being the subject of experience, really, it's just another kind of perception. You know, it's not something that it sits behind all other experiences receiving them somehow, like a immaterial soul or something like that. No, it's something else that the very, very tightly dependent on particular brain mechanisms. And the experience of being a self is also composed of many potentially separable elements. One of the most obvious of these is the experience of embodiment. William James, who is one of the founders of psychology, used to talk about it in the following way. And he would say that the experience of being a body is somehow always there. It's always in the background. You know, our experience of the world around us is changing as we move around it. But there's always the experience of the same old body going along for the ride. And because it's always there, you know, it changes, but pretty slowly over the course of a lifetime, you know, unless you have an injury or something or an illness, it's tempting to just push it also into the background and think we don't really have to explain it. But the experience of what is and what is not the body is another kind of controlled hallucination. And we can demonstrate this very easily. There are plenty of experiments. And one of the things I show in the TED talk is this thing called the rubber hand illusion, which is a very simple demonstration where you have a fake rubber hand, looks like a real hand, and you put it in front of someone. They hide their real hand. Then the experimenter takes a paintbrush, two paintbrushes, and strokes the rubber hand in time with stroking the person's real hand, even though they can't see this happening to their real hand. So from the subject's point of view, what they see is a fake hand that looks like a hand and is roughly where a hand should be. They see it being stroked, and they feel the stroking because their real hand is being stroked as well. And for the brain, this becomes enough sensory evidence that it updates its best guess about what's going on so that the person actually starts to experience the rubber hand as being part of their body. It's a really uncanny experience. And you know, at one level, you know it's not part of your body, but another level, you feel it is part of your body. And this shows that even something as basic as what is and what is not our body, even something as basic as that is actively on the fly, always a best guess, a hypothesis to the best explanation generated by the brain. And then that applies, I think anyway, to pretty much all other aspects of self that we have, whether it's the experience of making a volitional movement when I intend to do something and I feel I've caused that movement. That's just the brain's best guess of a movement that had a relatively internal versus external cause. It's not evidence for any kind of free will or anything like that. So all these elements of selfhood can all be explained by mechanisms. Of course, it doesn't seem like that to me. You know, even doing these experiments and thinking about these things for many years now, it still doesn't seem like that to me. I seem to be, you know, this unified self somehow sitting somewhere between behind my eyes, looking out on an external world. I mean, that still seems to be the way things are, even though we can do all these experiments to show that what's actually happening under the hood is something quite different.
Yeah, I've heard of the rubber hand illusion and or the rubber hand experiment. It's so fascinating. And I mean, I think this, the whole kind of conversation of, you know, what is the self? What is the body? What is our experience of it? And the fact that if you really kind of keep digging and asking these questions, it's not that clear or that obvious or even that sort of scientifically coherent as in terms of what we think it is. And in many ways, it kind of opens a door philosophically. It makes me think of people like Alan Watts and others. And it's really, really fascinating kind of journey and sort of rabbit hole that you can go down.
That's right. I mean, I think there's many other paths that people can take when they really are interested in understanding the origin and the structure of their experiences of world and self. Some of them, what I do in the lab here is the more scientific one, where we will try to manipulate these experiences in systematic ways, figure out what's going on. But of course, there are traditions of mindfulness and meditation, which can lead to similar insights. You know, different meditation is not going to deliver by itself a neuroscientific explanation of what's going on, but it also poses similar challenges to our assumptions of the unity of the self and the, you know, this naive realism by which we experience the contents of our perception as reflecting and being identical with some external existence, some external reality. And certainly we can take various kinds of substances and also alter our perception in different ways too. And religious ceremonies also can do this. I think there's a common theme to a lot of these things though, which is that I'm thinking here of something like an out-of-body experience. So these happen. People have out-of-body experiences. They feel that they've left their body. They're seeing their body from a different perspective. They may be floating above it or leaving it behind in some way. And people have reported these kinds of experiences throughout history in various sorts of contexts. And they've usually accompanied these reports with some sort of explanation of what's going on. And it's, you know, often something like, well, I've had an out-of-body experience, so therefore my soul has left my body and has started flying around. And this is where I think we get into a little bit of trouble, because we should take very seriously that people have these experiences, but the kind of intuitive explanation for them might not be right. And in this case, almost certainly isn't right. So the explanation for an out-of-body experience is going to be something like the brain has, for whatever reasons, maybe suddenly cut off from input coming from inside its own body, that its perspective, the origin of its first-person perspective, is now somewhere else. But that experience is still generated by the stuff inside that person's skull. And that, I think, thinking of things this way is very helpful, because it preserves the importance of these kinds of unusual experiences that people have about the dissolution of their ego or an out-of-body experience or whatever it may be. But it provides a more satisfying mechanistic explanation for what's going on. And that way, I think, leads to a fuller understanding of how our experience of the self is actually constructed and how it can fall apart in the ways that it can fall apart and sometimes does.
So how has this understanding of the self and the way that it's constructed impacted the way that you kind of think about life and think about your own self?
That's a great question. And I often wonder what a similar version of me would be like that had, you know, done something completely different, had not been interested or been researching in consciousness and neuroscience at all. Then I'd be properly able to answer your question. As it is, there's only been one of me, so it's hard to compare with the counterfactual. But what I can say is that sometimes it just fades into the background. I mean, sometimes it's just what you do in the lab and you're getting your papers out and you're trying to get your grants and you're having some detailed discussion about the statistics on this or that experiment, and you get equally frustrated by things in your life and in the world than you would do otherwise. But there are times, and for me it's often when I'm maybe having some sort of thinking time or going for a walk or just sitting back in a chair for a moment, and where I realize that my experience then is this construction, is not this external reality. And I think for me, this is really quite an enlightening and wonderful experience, this realization that what I am experiencing is this construction, this on-the-fly construction of the brain, that it's not necessarily the way things are, that it's not necessarily the way things seem to other people. So it can change the way you interact with other people if you can, you know, hold this in the mind at the right time, that they may be believing, seeing things that are actually slightly different from you. I also think that it has the potential to change one's relationship with one's own emotional states. And I think this is probably one of the more important implications, both scientifically and in terms of personal development. And the story here would go something like this, that just as my experience of something out there in the world is an interpretation of, let's say, visual signals or light bouncing off objects, my experience of having a particular emotion is also another aspect of self. It's also another interpretation of sensory data. But in this case, it's of sensory data that largely comes from inside the body, and how the heart is beating, how tight my stomach is, and what the level of various chemicals in my bloodstream are. And this is, again, an old idea that emotions are really perceptions of changes in the physiological state of the body. But again, it carries this implication that the way you feel at any time is the brain's best guess about what's happening to its body. It's not necessarily the way things are or the way things have to be. And if you can sort of appreciate that in the moment, I think it can help you with emotional regulation, with emotional control, with being aware of what's happening to you and sort of sometimes breaking vicious circles of negative emotions. Now, you know, in my own life, this is still very much a work in progress. You know, I often enter states where I just feel the way I feel. And if it's a negative set of feelings, those persist and amplify each other. And I find it very difficult to apply what I know about the mechanisms of emotions to changing my lived experience of them. But I do think the potential is there for applying these insights in my own life. And I think the potential is also there scientifically once we understand the mechanisms of what underlies the generation of particular emotion and mood states, then we'll have also a much better handle on developing treatments for conditions like depression or negative emotions, anxiety, and so on and so forth. But it's certainly not a shortcut. It's not that you study neuroscience and then you become enlightened and everything suddenly is revealed to be a different way. I think it does impact, but you have to continuously pay attention. You have to continuously bring it to mind, the relevance of what you're doing for your everyday life. But it's definitely there.
Would you be willing to share a little bit of your own journey or your own kind of battle with negative emotional states and kind of how you've dealt with those?
Yes, I would. It's, for many years now, and not that frequently, but from time to time, and like many other people, I've had episodes of unipolar depression. So the kind of depression where you just sink into very, very negative emotional states without the corresponding kind of manic and high state that some people get on the other side. These states of depression are only have my own benchmark to go by, but they are completely debilitating and I wouldn't wish them on anybody else at all. Now, this has been going on for me on and off for much longer than I've been studying consciousness and neuroscience. And, but it has been a motivation at the same time, because I've always, I've been interested in what's actually happening to me here, what's happening to my brain and my body that brings about these conditions. I mean, one of the things about the phenomenology of depression, it's not just persistent sadness. It's something very, very different from that. And in fact, in my own experience, I feel states of depression kind of often most prominently in my body. You know, you'll feel very, very negative symptoms coming from the way you experience your limbs. You know, I feel that they really shouldn't be there in some way. So there's clearly something going on with how the brain is interpreting signals from its body. But then, of course, you end up cycling into lots of rumination and negative thinking and self-blame and all the other self-reinforcing things that go on that sustain and deepen these depressive episodes. Now, I mean, I have not got a solution. I certainly think there are many approaches which seem to be partially successful for and work differently for different people. So I'm not going to say anything particularly conclusive, for instance, about medication. So we have things like SSRI medication, serotonin reuptake inhibitors, like citalopram or Prozac. These work for some people. They work better for some people than for other people. But they are a pretty blunt pharmacological tool. You're not going in and delicately adjusting the mechanisms of the brain to fix a particular problem. You're kind of treating the brain like a kind of bag of chemicals and just spraying a bit more into it. And there was an analogy I think I heard, you know, if you're taking an SSRI, is something like if you've got a car engine that's not working properly, you just open the hood and pour a bunch of oil all over the engine and hope some of it gets to the right place. It's a bit like that. It's pretty nonspecific, but it can work a little bit. And of course, cognitive behavioral therapy also has a very important place in helping us resist the kind of vicious circularity of the negative thinking that can happen. I, in the research that I'm doing, and this is, you know, other groups doing this too, trying to understand the mechanisms of depression in a more precise way about how the brain predicts and controls the internal state of the body. And I think this is an extraordinarily important line of work because it's not just from my own personal experience, it's the statistics out there for anybody to read. The impact, the social and economic impact of depression is huge, not to mention the cost in personal suffering that depression causes, and it doesn't seem to be going away anytime soon. So coming up with a better mechanistic understanding of what's going on, I think, is one of the more important things that anybody doing neuroscience could be doing. It doesn't necessarily help in the day-to-day. So the struggles that I personally have with it, one just tries to occasionally hold in one's mind the idea that these negative feelings, these emotional feelings, aren't necessarily reflecting the way things are or the way things have to be, that they will pass, that it will be possible to feel different again. And I think the way I can use the neuroscientific knowledge here is just to give myself a reason to expect things to pass, to expect things to, that however low you get, they will get a bit better. It may not seem like that at the time, but it does seem to be like that in the end.
What interventions have you found to be the most effective for yourself in kind of mitigating some of those symptoms or experiences?
Personally, I've found the sorts of things that you often hear work for people. I mean, it becomes really not that much based on my scientific knowledge of these matters anymore. There's the importance of reconnecting with the world around me. So what's always worked for me when nothing else really works is to go for a long walk in the country. Partly that there's a rhythmicity to that, I think, that sets the body doing something. There's the sort of the right kind of sensory stimulation that prevents you from, you know, the world is still there. The world doesn't really care about, you know, whatever the proximate cause of your depression might be at a particular time. Exercise, fresh air, nature. I mean, I'm not saying anything that's remotely new here at all. The key is, and this has been for me, is that you forget that these things work. You know, you forget and you think that's not going to work. There's no point. But if I do get myself out into the world a little bit, it does make a big difference. But there is no one thing that I've found that, you know, I can say, okay, it's time for that now. Sometimes it's a case of waiting it out a little bit as well, and gradually things get a little bit more into perspective. And cognitive behavioral therapy has also helped. We're all, I think, prone to our own internal echo chamber this way. We think thoughts that reinforce the thoughts that we've already been thinking or the beliefs that we already have about ourselves and our place in the world. And so to break that vicious circle through embedding, we're trying to make automatic certain responses to negative thinking is also extremely, extremely helpful. That's also worked for me too at times.
Well, thank you for going into that and sharing your own personal experience. I think it's courageous and also really valuable for our listeners to kind of hear that and hear someone who's obviously a very accomplished scientist still struggles with some of these issues and also what you've done to kind of help mitigate that.
Yeah, I think we all know there's still a stigma out there about mental illness. And I think it should be, I think whatever any of us can do to challenge that is a good thing. And whether if this helps in some small way, then I hope that's also a good thing too. I don't want to give the kind of the other completely wrong impression also that these episodes can also be pretty transient. And one of the things that I would caution against is, and again, this is part of the stigma aspect of it, I think, too. People aren't defined by their suffering from this or that psychiatric issue or mental health problem or psychological problem, however you want to describe it, in the same way that you wouldn't define somebody by their suffering from a more obviously physiological disease, for having a cold or having the flu or something like that. It can affect you, and it certainly changed my personality in some ways, but hopefully in a way that's some sense made me more aware of my own inner emotional states and what affects them. So yeah, that's just the flip side of the coin as well is that those of us that have experienced things like that would not want to be defined that way either. I think the same would probably go for pretty much anybody in that condition.
Well, thank you again for sharing that personal experience. I think it's really valuable and helpful. To kind of segue back to the broader conversation we've had, what would be, for listeners who've kind of listened to this episode and are curious about consciousness or learning more, or even maybe who's struggling with something like depression, what would be kind of one action step or kind of piece of homework you would give them to implement some of the ideas we've talked about today?
That's a good question. I think go and do a course in neuroscience. That's one action step. And I'm kind of half serious about that. I think there's a lot of good, popular, accessible literature out there now about the brain, about emotion, about neuroscience and perception, that even a non-technical understanding of this can help develop this realization that the way we experience things, the world around us and ourselves, isn't necessarily the way things are. Of course, delayed in writing my own book about this, but hopefully I'll be able to talk more about that next year. And the other action step is, I think, and again, this may not work for everyone, it's just when you're walking around in your daily life, try to make it a routine, just experiment with this for a little bit. And I'm just thinking about this now, maybe this works, but if you just walk around and now and again, just reflect on your own perception. Just reflect on what you're experiencing at that moment and try to experience it as a construction. If you see patterns of light and shade and objects, try to understand that your experience of the things in the world at that moment, how they might be generated by this interaction between the brain guessing about what's out there and the light coming into your eyes. So try just a little bit to get under the hood of your own experiences now and again. And I think if you can do that, that would be another avenue towards understanding this relationship between the naive realism that our experiences have, where we just, as we've discussed a lot already in this hour, that we just experience things as real, and this appreciation of how, in fact, dependent our experiences are on on how the brain is bringing its side of the story to what's going on.
And where can listeners find you and your work online?
The best place to look, I try to collect everything at the moment on my personal website, which is anilseth.com. There's a number of other podcasts and interviews and pieces of writing, and also a whole load of research papers from myself and my lab there as well. So anilseth.com would be the place to look.
Well, Anil, thank you so much for coming on the show, sharing all of your wisdom and experiences. Fascinating conversation, and I really appreciate your time and contribution.
Thanks again for the opportunity. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you so much for listening to The Science of Success. We created this show to help you, our listeners, master evidence-based growth. I love hearing from listeners. If you want to reach out, share your story, or just say hi, shoot me an email. My email is matt@successpodcast.com. That's matt@successpodcast.com. I'd love to hear from you, and I read and respond to every single listener email. I'm going to give you three reasons why you should sign up for our email list today by going to successpodcast.com, signing up right on the homepage. There's some incredible stuff that's only available to those on the email list, so be sure to sign up, including an exclusive curated weekly email from us called Mindset Monday, which is short, simple, filled with articles, stories, things that we found interesting and fascinating in the world of evidence-based growth in the last week. Next, you're getting an exclusive chance to shape the show, including voting on guests, submitting your own personal questions that we'll ask guests on air, and much more. Lastly, you're going to get a free guide we created based on listener demand, our most popular guide, which is called How to Organize and Remember Everything. You can get it completely for free, along with another surprise bonus guide, by signing up and joining the email list today. Again, you can do that at successpodcast.com, sign up right at the homepage, or if you're on the go, just text the word SMARTER, S-M-A-R-T-E-R, to the number 44222. Remember, the greatest compliment you can give us is a referral to a friend, either live or online. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us an awesome review and subscribe on iTunes, because that helps boost the algorithm, that helps us move up the iTunes rankings, and helps more people discover the science of success. Don't forget, if you want to get all the incredible information we talk about in the show, links, transcripts, everything we discuss, and much more, be sure to check out our show notes. You can get those at successpodcast.com. Just hit the show notes button right at the top. Thanks again, and we'll see you on the next episode of The Science of Success.
One, two, 3, 4. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.